Don't leave your name and message. I'll get back to you.
This is Esther, your father's friend. So you helped me move. That's it? You couldn't call? See if maybe I don't like the new place? See if maybe there's some painting to be done?
Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me to my left is Jason.
Hello, everybody.
And we're going to talk today a little bit about a phenomenon that seemed to really take root in the 70s, and that is the detective show. And this was brought on basically by the departure of one of Jason's biggest idols, James Garner, star of The Rockford Files, which was on for the majority of the 70s.
And yes, it was.
Quite iconic.
Very iconic, and I think that's the best way to kick this thing off. It's really, like you said, is what spawned the idea to even do this. It's such a cool departure for us to do something that's I think it's a bit of a departure. It's not like, you know, necessarily toy and sci-fi and nerdy. You know,
we'll get toys and sci-fi in there.
Oh yeah, we'll still fit them in.
Yeah.
But James Garner passed away a few weeks ago, and I think he was 83 or 86. I knew it was coming for a while. He hadn't been well. But it's one of those things that really had me sort of take stock. He's one of those people in my life. I didn't know the man. We weren't friends or anything, but he was such a presence, a constant presence, you know, on television and movies for me, and such a mini sort of hero of mine that it really hit me. You know, we're going to keep losing people like this that we loved and grew up with.
Yeah, I'm just going through the list of shows, and, like, it's just a death pool. Like, 90 – okay, Brett is still alive, right?
He's still alive and dangerous as ever.
Yeah, even more dangerous. Yeah, okay, there really is. A lot of these guys are gone, man.
Well, I think – and the thing that really – got me about Garner was, I think he's one of these guys, I stand by this, I think he's one of these guys that was so good at what he did that I'm not saying he was taken for granted because he had a, you know, 50-year career, whatever it was, but he was so good at what he did and he made it look so easy that I think people sort of took for granted what a professional he was and what a great actor he was. He never stretched in a way, you know, like a Brando or a De Niro, you know, back in the day, that kind of thing.
Yeah, he had a real likability about him, though.
Incredible presence, incredible likability. And he had a way, to me, it was something akin to a little bit of Cary Grant, where he was at ease doing a drama as a light comedy, as a flat-out comedy, and was very good at it. And when you find someone like that, even like a Harrison Ford, maybe, that is so good looking and has such a physical presence that are you know, really comfortable doing physical comedy and making fun of themselves, etc. That, I think, is part of the likability. Paul Newman, you know, had it in a way that Redford doesn't. I think Redford, you know, I remember a great story. We're going to go off on many tangents in this episode, as we always do, but a great story about him possibly going to be The Graduate, the lead in The Graduate. Mm-hmm. And he's out with Mike Nichols and they're shooting pool. And I'm paraphrasing, but the story that Nichols told was he was trying to describe what the character was to Redford. And he said, you know, he's the kind of guy that doesn't always get the girl. And Redford stopped playing pool and he just looked at him and said, well, how do you mean? What do you mean? And right there, Nichols is like, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
He's not going to get it. So Redford, I think, was always kind of aware. I mean, Newman was no dummy. He knew he was handsome. But he was so likable and so goofy that it diffused a lot of that and made him much more accessible. And Garner, I stand by this. Watch The Great Escape, one of the coolest movies ever. You got McQueen and Garner on screen together. James Garner is one of the single most handsome specimens in the history of motion pictures in that movie. He plays.
You touch upon their vulnerability, and really, I think Jim Rockford was a bit of a likable loser at times.
Jim Rockford was, for my money, the greatest show of the 70s, even though it ended in the early 80s.
What about, hey, no, don't step on Hello Larry's toes, fella.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm going to paraphrase. I mean, I'm going to fix that. But it also is the best detective show ever made. And I think a couple of things happened, as precursors to Rockford. He did a couple of movies. I want to say late 60s, first was late 60s, second was early 70s, one was called Support Your Local Sheriff.
Oh, yeah.
And the other was called Support Your Local Gunfighter.
Yeah, those are good movies.
Great movies. Watch those and watch a movie called Marlowe. He plays Philip Marlowe. It's 1966 or 67. Carol O'Connor is in it. I forget who the woman is, but Garner plays Marlowe as a cock. All three of those are the precursor to Jim Rockford, to this character. Oh, and also in Marlowe, two great scene-stealing bits with Bruce Lee, one of the first things Bruce Lee ever did in Marlowe. And they're precursors to Garner. And the thing that precursors to Rockford. The thing about Rockford was he, $200 a day plus expenses. He lived in this trailer on the beach in Malibu, wherever it was. Had a great car. Didn't always get paid.
Wasn't allowed to carry a gun, right?
He kept his gun in the cookie jar.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But he didn't always carry it. He was great with his fists, but he got beat up. Great with the ladies. Didn't always get the girl. He also was frequently in trouble with the cops. He had his best friend was, Dennis, the lieutenant on the force, but the rest of the cops didn't really like him. He was an ex-con. I think he went to jail for something he didn't do. So he wasn't the typical hero. He wasn't bulletproof, some really groundbreaking stuff in Rockford. The writing was fantastic. Remember, the show was created by Stephen J. Cannell, who did all those great shows.
It's got one of the most memorable Mike Post theme songs, I think, of the 70s.
I think the best theme Mike Post ever did. It charted. I think it went top 20 as a
yeah.
song. And David Chase, who went on to create The Sopranos, was a big part of Rockford. A lot of that great writing came from David Chase on the show. I just loved the show. I mean, I watched it with my dad and my brothers. We watched it in reruns, and it sort of became synonymous not only with Garner but with L.A. for me. So when I first moved to L.A., if I'd go to a taco stand, I couldn't help thinking of Rockford stopping at a taco stand, and all these weird things in L.A. that were very specific that I didn't know about in the Midwest. He also, and I'm not going to harp on it too much, but he also, as a man, just as a human being, was really a tough son of a bitch. And when they say they don't make him like that anymore, they really don't. He sued the studio. He sued Universal. I think while they were making Rockford, for royalties that were due to him at a time when no one did such things, A, and B, his advisors and everyone that knew him said, if you do this, your name is mud. Like, you're never going to work again. And he won, and he got his due. He marched for civil rights on Washington. He got two Purple Hearts in the Korean War. And if you watch him in Rockford, watch him when he runs. He's got a bit of a limp from his injury. He also did the majority of his stunt driving in Rockford.
That's
you watch
cool.
those scenes. That's him behind the wheel. He was a real racing fanatic. Just a one of a kind and one of the greatest voices. And when you talk about likability, do you remember the Polaroid commercial?
Well, I was going to bring those up. That whole thing, my mom thought this was hilarious, that the world thought he was married to Marriott Hartley.
Yeah. They had such chemistry, and yeah. And that campaign ran for years.
Yeah, it was it's another thing, in this world, we like with three channels, you could run a TV commercial, and most of us would see it.
Yes.
And I remember those really well. That whole thing with him and Marriott Hartley, and it's weird, it's pre-internet, so people can't just look it up and dismiss it. But I totally remember that. I was going to bring that up.
Huge impact. Watch those commercials. Go to YouTube and check them out, people, because you just can't help but smile when you watch those things. They had such great chemistry. And he the other thing that's interesting, you just said three networks made me think of it. Unless I'm very much mistaken, Rockford ran from 75 to 81, I think. I think it won a couple of Emmys. It might have won an Emmy for drama. He won at least one Emmy. But it only – I think it only was in the top 20 a few times. It was not a top 10 show. It just was a consistent show that everybody loved, and it was on for a long time, and it just – you know, it just was quality freaking television. And last thing I'll say is he's one of those rare guys that was – I don't want to say big, you know, like huge box office, but he was popular and big in movies and television. Started with Maverick, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s with Maverick. Went into movies, went back to television at a time and as a rule when, you know, a lot of stars poo-pooed television. They used to say, you know, if I ever did television, I would be slumming it.
Mm-hmm.
He was as comfortable in The Great Escape and those other movies I mentioned. I think he did at least one romantic comedy with Doris Day. I think it was called The Thrill of It All.
Yeah.
I think Norman Jewison might have directed it. As comfortable in those flicks as he was on Rockford. Whatever else he did, he is synonymous with Rockford. And, man, he just... I just cannot get enough of watching that guy. I just love him, and I miss him already. So that's what got us going about this episode, talking about detective shows. And I really do feel that the 70s was sort of the heyday of the detective shows.
What you seem to need, what the formula seemed to be, was a character actor and a last name. So, yes. You know, you put George Peppard in it, and you write the words Banachek. You know, and that's the show. Yep. And not to belittle it, but that seemed to be the formula. And I don't know where the you know, Detective Zero was, but I got to think one of the earliest ones, like, was the was Columbo.
Columbo, of course. Yeah. I can't believe I didn't put that on my list.
You know what? I can't believe it. But
such an idiot.
Columbo always reminds me of an age in my 20s because I was unemployed.
Yep.
And my day revolved around Columbo, which is really sad. Well, and then my day, you know, when A&E stopped playing Columbo, my day revolved around Banachek, and then my day started revolving around Macmillan and Wife. It was getting a little weird.
Well, it's interesting, though, because you mentioned, you know, Columbo and Banachek, like, in the same breath. I think they both started as a series of
Sunday night movies, or I was too young to catch them live.
Yeah, like the Sunday night mystery or the Monday morning mystery or some shit like that.
No, I think it was Monday, but let's find out.
And then and Columbo was late 60s, and then eventually,
it was the NBC mystery movie.
NBC mystery movie. It started late 60s, then became a series. Banachek, I think, kind of started the same way. Interesting bit of trivia, because
McLeod.
God knows I'm full of it.
Yeah.
Well, McLeod. Okay, here's two cool bits of trivia. Columbo, unless I'm totally wrong, and again, remember, people, I mostly do this without a net. I am not checking the internet as we do this. Columbo, if you've ever seen a film called Diabolique, French film, it was eventually remade with Sharon Stone and Kathy Bates, I think.
I pretend not to know that, but yeah.
But the original is fantastic.
Yeah.
It is such a great film noir kind of thing.
That's the school teacher who puts the fellow in the pool. Yeah, that is, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. One of the greatest climaxes ever since Deep Throat. No, take that out of the show. It's a terrible joke. Great climax in the film. But the detective in that starts sussing things out. He's got a hat and he's got a rumpled kind of raincoat. And his gist was he'd finish up with you and he'd start to leave the room and then go, oh, wait a minute, there's one more. Well, with a French accent, in French. He'd say, well, wait, you know what? There's one more thing I had to ask you. And that was the inspiration for Columbo. his whole thing was the genius of that show was we all knew the answer. You know what I mean? Every freaking episode, you knew who the killer was. You knew what the gist was. You were just waiting for the cat and mouse to end until Columbo could finally put the cuffs on him. And Columbo seemed to know most of the episode as well. But I can't think of another show that gave you everything at the beginning of the mystery.
That is the uniqueness of that format. But you know, the whole persona of the character, that whole thing might not have been the same, because like Peter Falk is not the first Columbo.
No, who was the first Columbo?
An actor by the name of Bert Fried.
Bert Fried
played him in the night. Like Lincoln Levinson created this character in the 60s, and what I understand is they actually at one time courted Bing Crosby.
I'll see your Bing Crosby.
All right.
What was he called? Link Ray? Who was the guy you just
said? No. William. Oh, I saw this name a million times in my 20s. William Link.
I'll see your William Link.
Yeah.
And I'll see your Crosby. And I'll raise you a Dirk Benedict.
Dirk Benedict?
Dirk Benedict played Columbo on stage in London.
Oh.
For a spell.
Oh, okay.
He's a big listener, so I don't say anything you're going to regret.
How could I say anything bad about Dirk Benedict?
He listens to he's a big listener.
Mm-hmm.
Like that?
I like that.
See what I did there with the movie he did?
God.
The other thing.
Was, you know, you're the only person in the world that makes a reference.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting about MacLeod was inspired by a film that Eastwood did called Coogan's Bluff.
Knew that. Yes.
And he was a Western cop guy.
My dad watched MacLeod. So
now wait a second though. Wait a second. Was MacLeod, was he a detective or was he a cop?
I think he was a cop, but it was still a mystery show, right?
It was a mystery show, but he wasn't a detective.
Well, no, but I mean. You know, I don't know. I know he was part of the NBC Mysteries, so I'm assuming that...
I mean, they're all detectives.
It's been so long since I watched MacLeod. I think he was a detective. I don't know if you've ever seen The Simpsons where Dennis Weaver was on.
Uh-uh.
They do a parody of MacLeod, and it's just him riding on a horse shooting hippies.
Well, see, that's another thing that's great. You say Dennis Weaver. It's like the great thing about a lot of these shows we're talking about are this era... Just before it gets too glossy in the 80s, and I'll tell you exactly where the turn is this was a great time to me, reminiscent of those great actors of like the 40s. Let's say the Cagneys, the Bogarts, the John Garfields. You know, these weren't pinups. You had your Cary Grants and your other guys that were just, you know, your Tyrone Powers that were just drop dead handsome. But these were character guys that became leading men.
Yeah.
And a lot of Garner is the exception. He's, you know, Papard was a pretty handsome guy. But, you know, Dennis Weaver, Peter Falk, you know.
They're supporting guys.
Who was, wait a minute, I almost said Judd Nelson, but he was a lawyer. Delvecchio? Was that the lawyer?
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't think Delvecchio. I can't talk about that at all. I've never seen it.
I think he was a lawyer or something. But okay. Anyway, a lot of these guys, are, you know, these shows were based around, were, you know, were character guys.
Yeah.
That became leading men. The turn, I think, that's really interesting, and maybe you have reference for this or not, in Rockford, like the 79-80 season kind of thing.
Yeah, things get a cheesy everywhere in 79-80.
Well, they bring in a character called Lance something. I forget his last name.
Boyle?
Played by Tom Selleck.
Ah.
He is everything that Rockford isn't. He wears a tie. He is immaculate. He gets paid top dollar for his detective work. Everybody loves him. Like, he could walk in a room and fall down, and everyone would just fall in love with him. And it just was the bane of Rockford's existence. And yet he loved Rockford. He goes, come on, Jim, let's go solve the mystery together. Like, he didn't get what a lunkhead he was. But he just was one of those guys that was bulletproof. Nothing stuck to this guy.
And which would make him even more infuriatingly dislikable to the underdog.
Exactly. And yeah. He was in, I want to say, 2 or 3 episodes of Rock. And that really, even though he'd done, you know, stuff before, that launched Selleck's career. That made Selleck, because that led to Magnum. And Magnum is very, we'll get to Magnum, but Magnum is, to me, very much a bit of a Rockford archetype. He is, he fumbles, you know, he doesn't always get paid. He's goofy, falls down. He's handsome as all heck, but he makes, you know, a lot of mistakes and, you know, infuriates people and stuff. There was a bit of a Rockford thing going on there. But who did you, I mean, Rockford was my thing. Was there a show that you, besides McCloud, that you...
Well, as a kid, there was a couple. It's weird that we watched detective shows as kids. I never let my kids watch murder shows.
A lot of violence.
A lot of murders. You know, in addition to Columbo, I would have to say that there's a couple that make me laugh. But, like, my sister was fascinated with Barnaby Jones, but it wasn't in a good way. She just liked to watch him run.
Another great theme.
She thought Barnaby Jones was hilarious because he was a senior citizen.
Who's gonna win the race, Cannon or Barnaby Jones?
Well, and you know that's that. Okay, I'm gonna go forward to the other goofy charm. My friend, in the '90s, we would watch Cannon because we would get off on when, you know, Cannon would jump from an exploding building, and it was clearly a stuntman with a pillow in his shirt and a ball cap on. And we just, you know, and I think it was, I don't know if it was FX was playing Cannon at that time, and they had this commercial, and this commercial was basically just crapping on the show saying, you know, try to understand that Cannon has a good actor, blah, 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 and
right.
Try not to think about him when he's lying down or when he's eating, and they're just, you know. But, you know, that was another thing where, you know, they took an actor who is not a movie idol in any right. way, shape, or form,
right.
The Fat Man of Jake and the Fat Man, and then they gave him his own show, and, you know.
What a voice, though, right?
What a commanding voice.
What a voice, and you know what his voice is most famous for?
The intro to The Highwayman.
Okay, well, what his voice is second most famous for? Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yes, of course. And he was the voice of the Lone Ranger for a while.
And he was the voice of the Lone Ranger. And he stunt doubled for Silver.
Did he?
Yes, he did.
I think you made that up.
I made that up.
Yeah.
But there goes. That's more material to back up what I said. Not a guy that you would go. He'd be sitting around a bunch of executives going, "All right, we need a new detective show for the fall. Who can we get that's fast on their feet, that's sexy, that's going to look great with their shirt off? Who's available? Well, we got William Conrad. Fuck, book him. Great, get William Conrad." And what should we call it? You know, Slim? No, call it Cannon.
Yeah.
That's a great...
Cannonball. No. The other show I loved as a kid, and this is kind of a weird kid thing, is Quincy.
Now, Quincy wasn't a detective.
He was a forensic scientist who...
Pathologist.
Yeah, who solved...
Am I wrong, or did Quincy get laid way more than he should have?
Yeah, he had first of all, I lived in the world as a kid where this was what Oscar Madison did during the day.
Right. Right.
He went home and, you know, Felix was there. Yeah, Quincy, even the opening of Quincy has a way out of his league woman on his boat.
Oh, yeah, every episode he was getting it on with somebody.
Yeah, and Quincy also... Quincy has some famously bad episodes. I think there's one with punk rock that you can find on YouTube that is absolutely insane. But right. There was something
Does it match the come on, Law and Order. What's the guy in Law and Order?
Jerry Orbach,
Buck Rogers episode?
Lars Mangross? Yes.
I knew you would know the guy's name.
Yeah, I think.
Only you. You're the only guy, you're the only guy that would know the name of the character.
Yeah, no, it matches that. If I can find it, I'll put it on the show.
All right.
Because it is just, It is just terrible. And of course, you know. But yeah, there was something about Quincy that appealed to me. I guess it was the whole dead body thing, being a bit of a horror kid.
But it was an interesting. It was an interesting concept for television, you know, retracing, kind of a precursor to like a CSI kind of thing,
yeah.
You know, what he was doing. But as a side note, can we just say this now before we forget, because we already mentioned Rockford. Pound for pound, almost all of these shows had fantastic theme tunes.
Quincy didn't.
Quincy had an okay theme tune. It was no match for Rockford. Magnum, the theme to Magnum is fantastic.
Yep.
Rockford's brilliant. Barnaby Jones is a great theme tune.
Even Ironside is.
You know what I love too about, was Barnaby Jones the one where it was like, tonight, on tonight's episode of Barnaby Jones, guest starring Marjo Gortner.
It could be. I mean, I think those were like that Quinn Martin kind of.
A Quinn Martin production. And then it'd be like, tonight's episode, Monkey Do, Monkey Die.
I don't know where that comes from. Maybe it is Barnaby Jones. I can't remember.
I think it was Barnaby Jones. I think it was. But see, who was the – oh, you know what? I used to get – as a kid, I used to get – this is probably understandable as a child. I would get Marcus Welby and Barnaby Jones mixed up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I could see that.
Because they were both ancient people leading, you know, television. I mean, Buddy Ebsen. Who the frick would say, let's get a kick-ass detective show going with Buddy frickin' Ebsen?
Well, the fighting's going to be amazing.
I mean, Jesus. What? I mean – Cannon and Barnaby Jones. It's just
there's a team up actually, a fan that, fiction we should write.
Yeah, that's a Marvel team up. Cannon
and Barnaby Jones. Marvel team. Finally, we can launch that comic company we've been dying to do.
They just sit at their desks and solve crimes. They don't actually go out and do anything.
they just text or email.
So Barnaby Jones. We had Banachek, which is George Peppard.
Yeah, and you know I can't. For the life, I liked Banachek, and I sure as hell watched a lot of it, but I can't for the life of me remember a thing about it.
Well, you know what it is? It's George Peppard was one of those guys that he was popular, and he seemed to work all the time,
mm-hmm.
But man, was he just a block of wood on screen. I always thought he just had no presence and was just...
Really?
I just thought he was... I mean, ever since Breakfast at Tiffany's, he just seemed slightly effeminate and kind of ineffectual. And sort of by the time you got to the A-Team, when he's putting on the fake beards and the wigs and shit, it's so preposterous. There's a great story when I met, speaking of Dirk Benedict, Comic-Con, this guy could talk. He just, you know, get him, spin the top, and he just goes. And boy, did George Peppard hate Mr. T.
Oh.
Just hated him.
Don't shatter my childhood like this.
And he wouldn't – they got to a point where he wouldn't speak to him on set. He would turn to Benedict or Dwight Schultz and say, could you tell the man with the gold chains that we need to get going because – and they would, you know, relay the message to T because they were, you know, 20 feet apart and they wouldn't speak. I don't know if Peppard was such a purist as an actor. I don't know what it was, but he did not like T. So Banachek, it was just he just was around, but it wasn't a great show. Another show, I want to say this might have been late 60s. Remember Mannix?
Yeah, Mike Connors.
Mike Connors.
I more or less remember Mike Connors from Clorette's commercials.
Oh, yeah, I remember
that. Get tough with your breath.
And that was another great theme tune.
Mm-hmm.
Mannix theme is fantastic.
Mike Connors actually kind of always – he kind of – gives me that man's man vibe, you know, like
it's the hair. It's got to be the hair.
Yeah, I didn't watch a ton of Mannix, to be honest with you, but I do. It is kind of one of those shows that has probably it sure lasted a long time, and it was created by the same guys who created Columbo.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now we hit on Beretta. All these last name.
Yeah.
Was Beretta a detective or was he a cop?
I thought Beretta was... You know, I didn't watch a lot of Beretta either.
Do you remember his bird?
I remember the theme song. I remember his bird.
What a great theme song.
Yeah.
That charted. I think that charted too.
Sammy Davis Jr., yeah.
Sammy Davis Jr.
He was an undercover New York detective, according
to... Keep your eye on the sparrow.
Yeah.
Great theme tune. But another guy that you just go, this shouldn't have worked. This shouldn't have been a popular show. He's... You know, I'm not a tall guy. He's shorter than me.
He's eclectic, that's for sure.
He's a what?
He was an eclectic dude.
He was an eclectic dude. He had a real eclectic acting style, the way he sort of, you know, played. He was actually a very good actor. I mean, he was great as Brett, but
In Cold Blood?
In Cold Blood, he's fantastic in that movie. Hmm. He did another great movie. Oh, total tangent. You ever seen a movie called Electric Glide in Blue?
No, I've heard of it, though.
He's a motorcycle cop. It's, I want to say, early 70s. Check that out, people, if you can. Great underrated early 70s kind of show. And the ending will knock you out. You will never forget the ending. But he was another guy. You just go, we're going to build a show around this guy. You know what I remember most about him and that show were his Carson appearances. Do you remember him when he would show up on Johnny Carson?
No, I didn't watch Carson at that time.
He couldn't shut up. Like, he just was a motor mouth, and just that whole jive talk thing that he always had going on. See, Johnny, here's the thing, Johnny. I gotta quit the smoking, because the smoking ain't good for you, Johnny. You know, and I gotta. And he'd come on sometimes in the middle of trying to quit smoking, and he'd always had a cigarette in his hand, an unlit cigarette that he'd fumble with and play with. Do you remember how Carson used to smoke under the desk? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, he used to always take a puff and put it out in the ashtray under the desk. Anyway, okay, so we got Beretta, we got Banachek, we got.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to say about Beretta that's memorable is he was the one guy that the one imitation Tony Rizzotto on SCTV could do really, really well.
Tony Rizzotto, God.
Yeah.
Tony Rizzotto, what happened to Tony Rizzotto? Told me what happened to him.
He actually went through some real troubles. I think he had what was a psychotic episode, and he spent some time in. This is years ago, by the way. He spent some time in a mental institution, but from what I understand, he's a working actor again, and he's reconciled with his family, and he seems to be doing okay.
That was that season of SCTV. Was it Robin?
Robin Duke and Tony Rizzotto, and then they went on to Saturday Night Live.
That's right. We have to do an SCTV episode.
We do, but that'll be 8.5 hours long because. Well, pretty much that's how I got kicked out of my first year of university, was SCTV. Wow. Yeah, yeah, and the NBC movie.
Don't give us all the gold.
Yeah.
Save it for the SCTV episode. Okay, a couple of things that I'm gonna hit you with that may be inaccurate. I don't know, but they may fit into the mold. Two things. One was a show that I loved. I remember when it first aired, I watched every single episode. And it was my introduction to Jeff Goldblum, was a show called 10 Speed and Brown Shoe. Do you remember the show?
Never missed it.
14 episodes.
I know. It seemed like a year, 10 years long show as a kid. But,
totally.
Yeah.
But what a great, it was Ben Vereen and Jeff Goldblum.
And Ben Vereen was kind of like the con man character, right?
He was the con man character. He was 10 Speed and Goldblum was Brown Shoe. And Goldblum was a nerd. And he always tried to fight and tell people he knew, you know, karate and stuff, and give him a warning, and he'd get beat up and whatever. But great chemistry with those guys. That was another Stephen J. Cannell show. And the other thing is Barbary Coast. Now, was that a detective show?
No, I thought that was a cowboy show.
Well, it was a Western, but I thought he was like it was Shatner. It was
Shatner. Yeah, I've never seen it.
It's out on DVD now.
Well, it doesn't mean I'm
Well, no, I'm just saying, just in case you want to see it, it's out on DVD now. You can
apparently, according to Wikipedia, because I have not seen this show, it is a sci-fi Western. And it was a bit of a wild, wild west.
Barbary Coast?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's a government agent. And
sci-fi? Well, no.
Oh, wow. Shatner and Doug McClure. Ooh.
Now, that's it.
I might be into that.
That's another Marvel team up.
I love Doug McClure.
Doug McClure.
I will fight people who say they don't like Doug McClure.
Doug McClure, it was Land of Time Forgot.
Yep.
Journey to the Center of the Earth, I think, was him.
I love Journey to the Center of the Earth.
He led with his chin, as they say.
And to be perfectly honest with you, if I had to get an actor to play my dad in a movie, that's who I'd cast.
You could do worse than Doug McClure.
That's right.
Barbara, okay, Wild Wild West. Now that was more of a spy show.
It was, but so was Barbary Coast. They were spies.
Oh, they're spies. Okay.
So this is irrelevant to our conversation.
I'm so sorry. So the next big show that I sort of got hooked on was Magnum. I loved Magnum P.I. And I want to
so
say
no
that.
So no Vegas?
Vegas! I forgot about Vegas. That was a good show. That was – boy, talk – now there's a guy. There is a guy that does not get enough credit for the career he had. Robert Urich.
Yeah, he really was kind of a staple of television for a long time.
He had about 6 or 7 series.
Yeah.
And they ran and ran and ran. And Vegas was – do you know the story about Vegas? There's a restaurant out here in L.A. on Santa Monica Boulevard, West Hollywood, called Dan Tana's.
Oh, okay. I knew the character's name was Dan Tana.
Been around for, you know, 50, 60 years. It's an institution. What's-His-Face created the show, right? Wasn't it
Jimmy What's-His-Face.
Jimmy What's-His-Name. Was it Glenn Larson? Did he create the show or somebody?
You know what? I don't know. Is it Cannell?
But he named Dan Tana, you know, the character after the guy, the restaurant. Also, Robert Urich and David Soul, two 70s TV staples, were in the second Dirty Harry movie. Do you remember the second Dirty Harry, Magnum Force?
Yes, of course.
They were two of the cops. Remember the three cops?
Oh, you know, I haven't seen it in so long, I didn't even notice. Now, you know, Starsky and Hutch, of course, we can't.
Now they were cops, right?
They were cops. They were undercover detectives, though.
Right.
I guess we should have reinforced what we're, you know.
Sorry. You missed the meeting yesterday.
I did.
Well, that's the thing, though. See, they were undercover cops, heavily undercover, in the most obvious car in the history of television.
Yeah.
Anybody saw that car coming, they knew the cops were around.
Well, you know, I think the first couple of seasons of that show were pretty hard and heavy. Like, even the first season, it had this real Dirty Harry theme song, like this da-da-da-da-da. And I don't know if the censors had a word with them, but they lightened that show to where it is what most people remember it being, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of more of a lighthearted show, I guess.
Wasn't it a couple of likable guys? David Soul was the one that got a recording career and all the girls loved. But I thought Paul Michael Glazer was great. And he never really seemed to do much afterwards. He got into directing.
He got into directing, and he directed Kazam.
He directed Kazam. And he also showed up in that Diane Keaton Nicholson movie, As Good As It – no, I'm sorry. What If It Happens, or, you know, Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Whatever the hell it was called, When They Fall in Love or whatever. She was – it was one of those things where he just shows up and you go, where the hell has he been?
Yeah.
And he's like her ex-husband. And you go, he literally looks like he's about 10 years older than he was on Starsky and Hutch.
Yeah, he's put on a bit of beef.
But he looks fantastic.
Because he was doing these credit commercials around here for a while, and he'd go, get off the treadmill. And it was sort of like, you should get back on it. He has had some really bad personal life issues.
His wife. That's right.
Yeah. So.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
He's, you know, so that's probably why you haven't seen a lot of him. And from what I understand, David Soul just lived in England for a long time.
He did a lot of theater and stuff. He also did. You probably don't remember this. There was a short, very short-lived Casablanca television.
Yes. Yes.
Do you remember that?
He was Rick. Yeah.
Like, what were you thinking? How did that happen?
Well, you know, he's TV hunk Bree Bogart.
Yeah, and you remember this big hit song?
Don't Give Up on Us, Baby.
As a kid, you know, I used to get those lyrics mixed up all the time, different songs. Remember the one I told you about, Strangers in the Night Exchanging Glasses?
Yeah.
I pictured people at a party, you know, handing they're trying different glasses on, you know, like sunglasses.
Well, that's what cops do.
Don't give up on us, babe. I thought he was saying don't give up on a spade, meaning like if you're playing cards.
Oh, okay. I thought he was gardening.
If you got a spade, like don't fold yet. Keep playing the game. That's what I thought he was saying in that show.
So Blinded by the Night.
Revved up. Now, they are saying douche in that, though. I've looked it up.
Deuce.
No, it's douche. They're talking about going to the store looking for douche, and that's what I'm telling you. That's what it's about. Springsteen was really into that back then.
Personal freshness.
Personal freshness. So there's those shows. So Magnum comes on in 1980.
Yeah.
And the most significant thing that if anybody doesn't know this story, They've been clearly living under a boulder for many, many years. So, I think a pilot had been done, I think. And very much the way the Remington Steele thing happened with Pierce Brosnan, he was going to do Living Daylights. And they had like a 60 or 90 day option to renew Remington Steele.
Right.
It was all set. They did costume fittings, the whole nine yards. And like day 60, the phone rang. And it was, oh, they're picking up the show again for another season. And Cubby Broccoli's famous words were, Remington Steele will not be James Bond. Something similar happened with Tom Selleck. He was, I think, the offer had been made for him to play Indiana Jones. And
I think actually some storyboards are drawn to look like Tom Selleck.
Yes, and there's a great, you can probably find it on YouTube, but it's definitely on the DVD stuff, the making of screen tests with him and, is it Karen Allen at this point?
I'm not sure.
I don't know who it is, but he's in a fedora and a leather jacket doing the screen test.
And, you know, that makes a lot of sense because Selleck kind of looked like one of those Jungle Jim serial type stars.
Yeah.
He kind of had that Tristan Coffin kind of look about him. So not surprised that's there. You know, they were going for that. I think it's all just in the mustache and the square jaw. But, I do kind of think that's where they were.
He's hugely likable again. I guess the best way to put it with guys like him and Garner is they're drop dead handsome in a non douchey way.
Yeah, they're just nice guys.
Like Robert Wagner. I never had anything against Wagner, but Wagner's one of those guys that's so handsome, like he's pretty.
Wagner looks like he's naked without an ascot too. So
yes, yeah. Now Selleck and another great show. You ever see It Takes a Thief?
Oh gosh, ages ago. Yeah.
Yeah, he played a guy called Al Mundy. Great show. So Selleck is going to be Indiana Jones, but then CBS says we're going to pick up this show, Magnum PI. The next thing that's the story Spielberg always says is that happened, and then he goes to a screening of Empire Strikes Back, calls George Lucas and says, I know who Indiana Jones is going to be, and Lucas is like, Harrison Ford. Spielberg's like, yes, that's what I was going to say.
I like your Lucas impersonation.
Yeah, it's probably more like,
oh, Harrison Ford.
Yeah, and that was a time where we were thinking about doing Indiana, but I didn't want Harrison playing two people in the same sort of, I already used him three times, and I thought, you know, if you can picture I'm playing with my neck at the same time doing it.
I could.
So Harrison Ford becomes Indiana Jones. Magnum then goes on to run for like six or seven years. And it went from kind of goofy and kind of light to some real heaviness. They really played up the Vietnam thing. You know, he and TC and Rick being in, being Vietnam veterans. He was a private detective. He lived on the Robin Masters estate. John Hillerman played Higgins, who kind of ran the property. Magnum drove that amazing Ferrari. Both Magnum and Rockford had great cars too. Those are a couple of great cars. And he was hugely likable. Just, you know, the ladies loved him and guys weren't threatened by him because they felt like they could have a beer with him. And, you know, he was unorthodox in some stuff that he did. But I really, really enjoyed that show. And that was a show that that was taken on the early 80s. The detective thing was really in full swing. Simon and Simon kicks off.
Yeah.
And that, interestingly enough, had a completely different theme tune its first season. It was more like a Jimmy Buffett kind of...
Oh, yeah.
With horns and shit. And then, by the second season, great theme tune. It was a really good... It might have been a Mike Post thing.
It probably was. It sounds like his stuff.
That was another great great theme song. They were brothers, you know, very different guys. They were detectives, but they were brothers. That was a nice – there's an example. Jameson Parker. What was he called?
I think it's Jameson Parker and Gerald McCraney.
Was Jameson – who was the Hardy – who was Hardy Boy?
Neither of them were Hardy Boys.
No, but what was the Jameson Hardy Boy? Parker Stevenson?
Parker Stevenson, yeah.
All right, Jameson Parker was the blonde. There's an example of a guy – that's so cute, you just want to punch him because he's blonde and he's cute and everything. Not in a handsome Garner, sell it kind of way. So Simon was a pretty big show. Like I think they ran back to back. I think it was Magnum and then
Yeah, I watched a lot of Simon & Simon. In fact, I can remember one that was about comic books. And I was, you know, that like you just nowadays, you know, you can turn on the TV and find a geek show.
Yeah.
And even though this was a pretty terrible, you know, interpretation of comic books and comic book collectors and all that, it was still like, wow, they're doing something on, you know, comic book collectors.
I don't remember that. I remember one about a Lone Ranger type guy that, you know, was an actor that like got involved in a mystery, but they were both obsessed with the show as kids or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like a Masked Avenger kind of thing. Oh, wait a minute. What about Riptide? Was that a detective show?
I think so. Again, that's starting to get into like, I watched a lot of Riptide, but it, you know, it's starting to get into, it's getting less and less realistic. You know, these guys, I think they lived on a boat and they've got a robot and
they got a robot and
they've got a chopper,
From Vietnam.
Yeah. And it's,
they used to compete to see who could get the most broken noses.
Was it Perry King?
Joe Penny
and
Perry King.
Perry King was, really good for exploitation movies.
Mandinga.
Yeah, he did one called Seek and Destroy that's filmed in Niagara Falls, Canada, that I love. Nice. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, you're starting to get these I find that with Magnum, you started to get stuff like what is that guy's name? Matt Houston. Which is ABC's version of Tom Selleck, or you know, but the
Lee Horsley
of Magnum, but they get Lee Horsley because they're like, well, we need a guy with a mustache.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you what's interesting about that, or maybe not, depending on how much you're enjoying the show. Lee Horsley, before Matt Houston, there was a television version of Nero Wolf, the Nero Wolf Mysteries.
Okay.
And Cannon, William Conrad, was Nero Wolfe, and then the young, handsome, you know, muscle that went out and did the stuff was Lee Horsley.
Hmm.
We ran for a season. Then he went on to Matt Houston, and who was his lady sidekick in Matt Houston?
Pamela Hensley.
Pamela Ardala Hensley.
She was CJ.
CJ.
Yeah, and that show was cheesy as all hell.
Terrible. He was like a millionaire or something, and
they had that computer that, you know, had the internet before anybody else, but it made all the Star Trek sounds, you know.
Oh yeah. I literally haven't seen that since it aired.
But you know, we should go backtrack because we forgot one real police detective that took the country by storm, and you know, talking about merchandising, I think this character got more or as much as Starsky and Hutch, a show that was a little more aimed at kids, and that is Kojak.
Well, see, I was going to throw Kojak in, but I thought Kojak was a cop. We clearly should have had more meetings.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
this episode before we recorded. Can You're we right, start over?
No.
I think he was a cop, wasn't he?
He was, but you know, I lump him into these detective shows.
Who was the fat guy in Kojak?
Wasn't he supposed to be his brother?
It was. Yeah. It was. It was Savalas' brother.
Yeah.
But he wasn't the guy. He wasn't the, hello there. He wasn't that comedian. No, not that.
Who is that? That's Marty Allen. Still alive.
Hello there.
And he has a website.
That's the guy's whole. He's like Senor Wences. The guy
he did a Monster Squad.
The guy did a 70-year career with his hand, a Sharpie, and a little wig. That was the guy's whole routine. Marty Allen.
And his personal life.
Marty Allen, hello there. That was the whole.
Yeah, what the hell? What was his follow up to that?
Who was the guy, you know,
Charlie Callis.
Jesus, Charlie Callis. I knew you'd know who that was. Charlie Callis, like the Jerry Lewis telephone. Like, they can't book any
Legends of the Superheroes. Yeah, I love Charlie Callis.
You can always get Charlie Callis. Like, he was never too busy for the
Grew up in a neighborhood so tough that the priest was named Father Knuckles. You know, so
and everything
funny.
Was that.
But you know, like, I never understood the appeal of Kojak. Like, why there was an action figure.
He had a lot of toys, right? There was
an action
figure. There was a playset, too, right?
A playset, yeah. Kojak's office.
But it
What's
was
your
his
file?
Office.
And it and came with a bad guy that was actually like a cowboy bad guy from another toy line.
I'll tell you where it was big was the
England.
UK.
Yeah.
That was a huge – he got a Corgi car.
Corgi car. He got a Power Record.
He got a Lone Star cap gun.
Yeah.
Lone Star made a Kojak friggin' cap gun. Also, bit of trivia, Telly Savalas, missing, what, two fingers?
I did not know that.
He's missing a finger or two – I think his index finger is like half gone.
Oh.
Yeah. Also played Blofeld in Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, which a lot of people don't like. I think he's a pretty good Blofeld.
He's a good Blofeld. He's undone by the chickens. You love chickens. You know, when he's trying to hypnotize the women at night, telling them, you know, their phobias, the reverse of their phobias and stuff.
Yeah.
That's a bit rough. But Kojak was huge. You're right. That was huge.
Yeah.
We might as well throw in, if you're going to mess with the formula here and throw in every law enforcement official.
You know, if you were actually savvy to this, you would yell at me like a police chief and say, you know,
you're on notice.
Yeah.
What do you think you are? You're out there like a...
We're off our game today.
So. One man wrecking crew.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
We might as well throw in Police Woman. That was a huge show.
Yeah, with Angie Dickinson.
She got toys.
Those toys actually weren't Police Woman toys. I don't know if you know this.
They were.
No, they weren't. They were. It was a British line called Havoc, and it was a beautiful box art, amazing idea of girl spies, and later on Hasbro would do a lot of this with Charlie's Angels, but the dolls had these humongous heads.
Okay.
It was really weird. Like, if you look at the packaging, you go, this is an awesome toy. And then when you look at the dolls, you're like this, it's like brat sized heads. And the Angie Dickinson, all that stuff, the Police Woman line by, I think it's Durham, is actually this British line called Havoc.
Well,
that's
didn't
been
she have,
repackaged.
Like, there were loads of outfits and stuff.
Yeah,
too.
And they're all like things like she's, you know, underwater or she's in a disguise or, you know, it's all the Havoc stuff repackaged.
Pepper
Anderson?
Pepper Potts? No.
No.
Pepper something. But that was a really big show because that was, and it was groundbreaking. I'm sure it's incredibly dated today. I haven't seen it in 30 years, but that was a very
good. They even made rack toys. I think one of them is featured on the cover of my book.
Hey, no pun intended.
Yeah, yeah. And what
let's get to that because we're already at 7 hours for the show.
We are.
Ironically, you know, this is an era of these big shows. They run for a long time. They're very popular. Every season, the network wants to have another detective show. But I feel like there wasn't a ton of merchandise associated, which kind of makes sense because I suppose in the long run, you know, if kids are at the drugstore with mom, they're not asking for a, you know, McMillan and wife, you know, doctor set or something.
We never even talked about that show. I always thought it was like The Thin Man.
I think it kind of wanted to be, sort
yeah.
of.
Yeah, and then they did that lamentable thing when Susan St. James didn't want to come back. They kept going.
I had such a crush on Susan St. James.
Yeah, she had a lot going for her. And she Nancy did, Walker, you know.
I had a big crush on Nancy Walker.
Yeah.
You want a bit of trivia about Nancy Walker?
Oh, that she hung around with Richard Deacon a lot?
I didn't know that.
Oh.
She directed Thank God It's Friday.
Yes, I know that. Yeah.
She directed Thank God It's Friday. And Steve Guttenberg told a story once, because he was in that, about how the rap party was so bizarre because it was just that era of disco and freaky things happening at clubs and shit. And somebody was pumping amyl nitrate through the venting system.
Mm.
And I guess Nancy Walker like tried to eat her own hand or something. I don't know what happened, but I just pictured that whole scenario and it's like, you know, could only have happened in 1980. You know, that she even directed, I don't think she ever directed anything else, but she did that. But so that was Rock Hudson. Again, big movie star, suddenly doing television, was Rock Hudson, Susan St. James.
John Shuck.
John Shuck.
Holmes, famous, or Yo-Yo.
Famous Klingon and Yo-Yo.
And Herman Munster for a while.
And Herman Munster.
Yeah.
So he was in that. But merchandise-wise, you know.
There was a Columbo board game.
I always wanted like a Rockford, you know, model kit of the car.
That seems odd they didn't do that.
Never did that. You know, they did model kits.
You got Kojak's car, and it wasn't that fancy.
They did T.J. Hooker's cop car. It's just a cop car, for crying
out. Well, yeah, that's why they did that, though.
Right, but it's just like, who wants it? You know, you'd rather have Rockford's car.
Yeah, Rockford had a cool car.
I think Magnum got the most merchandise.
I would say Starsky and Hutch.
You think Starsky and Hutch got
more?
Well,
first of all, that show was bananas in England, just like Kojak.
Yeah.
You know, Starsky and Hutch, you even got a bad guy to chase around. Mego made a figure called Chopper.
I remember Chopper.
Yeah, and I spoke to the man who sculpted Chopper, because a lot of people make fun of that figure. Mm-hmm. And he says it was meant to have a three-day beard. Because it, you know, the figure just kind of looks like a caveman. But if you if you do a light wash, and I've never bothered to do it, but on the Chopper figure, it does look better that he has a bit of a light beard, and it's sculpted there.
If someone were just tuning in and heard you say, "If you do a light wash on your Chopper figure," we could be talking about anything. Interesting, you say that. The whole UK thing. The packaging was different too, right? The Palitoy packaging.
Oh yeah, in the UK they released Starsky and Hutch on cards. They didn't release the other cast members. Like, they didn't make a Huggy Bear doll or anything in the UK, but they put them on cards, and then you could also buy them in a 2-pack.
That's right.
Which makes sense. And then they released the car without all the bells and whistles, which was fine because the car in itself was kind of cool to have. It's not quite to scale. I mean, the guys look a little, you know, comfy in there.
Right.
Or cozy, I guess is the word. But I would have to say that, you know, Charlie's Angels, which we didn't really talk about, but I consider a detective show to some degree.
See, I think that's more of a spy show.
Yeah, okay. But they received a lot of merchandising. Starsky and Hutch, I would
say. You should have gone to a meeting yesterday.
I'm sorry. It was my dad's birthday.
Missing these meetings.
He's not going to turn 70 again.
That's right. No, Charlie's Angels, was big. But again, you know, if we're talking detective shows, I think Starsky and Hutch probably beats it. Starsky and Hutch, they also did Lone Star did a cap gun as well. Another company you'll probably know that I don't remember, was it Bradgate or Palitoy, did like a target game?
That was Berwick.
Berwick. Two pistols and you know, while we're on this subject, this show has been a great vehicle for me
To spend money?
To spend money, generate loads of income. But it's been a great little vehicle for me to mention something, and someone listening can go, oh, I remember that, and post a link or whatever. I have not been able to find this, but I swear, late 90s, I remember finding this on eBay, and I've tried every iteration on Google that I can think of for an image. I think a UK company, and I want to say it was something like Berwick or Thomas Salter Toys or something, did a Magnum PI spy set, and it came in a box, and it was his, you know, 45, and you know, handcuffs, the usual shit that came with it, and then his ring. Do you remember the ring that he had?
Oh yeah.
And that was in the box too, and it had really cool box art. I've never been able to find a trace of it since. If someone can back this up, I'd appreciate it. But Starsky and Hutch got a lot of merch, and then Magnum got lots of rack toys. Who did the rack toys for Magnum?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. Is it? It would probably in the early 80s have either been
not J. Rue, but
might have been Gordy. No. Oh, brother, H.G. No, that's not right either. I was holding an HG catalog when you said that. This is embarrassing. It would have been Fleetwood? Would it have been Fleetwood in the early 80s?
Fleetwood might be right. I think you're right. So they did a bunch of rack toys. His gun, a wallet. It might have been J. Rue. Because they did a wallet. One of those, you know, those plastic wallets.
Yeah, you're just, you know what, I'm all sixes and sevens, but usually I can name this off the top of my head. Gosh. That sounds familiar. I'll get that answer before.
So there were about, I want to say, six or seven rack toys, like binoculars, his sunglasses, the gun, wallet, handcuffs with a whistle, you know, stuff like that. You know,
as he's known to be whistling at all
the whistle, the rape whistle that he carried with him.
Yeah.
Gum cards.
Yeah, I bought my mom those because she had such a Tom Selleck crush.
Aw, that's sweet.
I almost bought her that car and figure.
Well, okay, I was just about to get to that. But do you remember the thing that was a big craze in the late 70s, early 80s, those TV trays?
Yeah.
Do you remember those?
Yeah. By the way, it is Ja Rule.
Ja Rule, okay. Yeah. You say Ja Rule, I say J-Ru.
That's fine.
So he got the TV tray, got puzzles, stuff like that. Corgi made the Ferrari, and I think they might have made the chopper back then. I don't know. But most famous of all, LJN did a not only an individually carded action figure of Magnum, they did the Ferrari and figure in a box, which has become incredibly sought after.
Why is that so rare?
I don't know, but it's on average that thing goes for $600 or $700.
I don't. Yeah, like there's a Magnum figure on eBay right now. It's loose. It's going for $75.
Well, I've got.
It looked like they just took some old Mego Dukes of Hazzard tooling and gave a Tom Selleck head.
That's pretty much what they did. Yeah. I have the figure and car. I found them loose years ago. You know, good shape. The figure is missing a thumb. But he didn't come with any accessories or anything.
No,
but it's just cool to have a Magnum figure. So that's a really, really rare piece.
Yeah, and it's very, very sought after too, which is surprising to me. But kids of the '80s, just you know, that's a huge thing for them.
Well, you know what I think is part of it? I think the box art is fantastic.
It is really good. It does kind of, for me, I'm not the biggest Magnum fan in the world, but it kind of reminds me of those Mego, you know, figure and car sets that they're famous for.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm obsessive with those. I have all the superhero ones, and I have the Greatest American Hero one. And, you know, you look at that, and it's like, hey, there's one I don't have. But technically, it's really not my thing.
Not in your purview.
Yeah, it's cool. I really like it. But it's one of those things that I won't die if I don't own. Well, nothing. Right. Nothing.
Well, I had the – I think I still have it somewhere. Do you remember the – I think it was LJN as well did these like key racers. It was like a hot wheel, and you stuck the key in the back of it and pressed it, and it shot off across the floor.
Yeah, I'm not. I can't guarantee that it was LJN, but that sounds kind of believable. But yeah, I remember those. I was way too old for that stuff.
I also had complete digression, slight side note. I had a pet. Never had a dog as a kid, but I had a bird. I had a cockatiel. You know the cockatiels? It's like half the size of a cockatoo.
Like Beretta's bird, wasn't it?
Beretta's was a cockatoo.
Oh, okay.
A big crest. Cockatiel is like less than half that size. Most of them are gray, some are white, and they have they have orange cheeks and yellow heads, yellow crests.
Yeah, okay.
Mine was called Higgins.
Oh my God, that's cool.
Named him Higgins.
So you were a fan from that right from the beginning, right?
Oh yeah, I never missed an episode. Never missed an episode. And then, you know, I was pretty into Simon and Simon. I liked the chemistry they had. That you unearthed not long ago, right? Didn't you unearth a rack toy for Simon and Simon that you didn't know?
I think I put it in the book. It was walkie-talkies. Yeah.
Walkie-talkies. And Matt Houston. You sent me the Matt Houston set.
I did. That's right, the Matt Houston ID card. Because what was the note I gave you? Like, now go get laid all over town or something like that.
Wear this and get laid all over town. Watch the doors fly open. Yeah, what's funny is it's not that different than one of the few Danger Mouse toys I've ever found is a Danger Mouse rack toy. I think it's J.Ru, and it's like his eye patch, and then everything else is the same as the Matt Houston set.
Yeah, well, if you know, one of the things is I've been collecting these rack toy catalogs for years, and I have dozens I haven't featured on Plaid Stallions yet because it takes forever to scan every single one of these things.
Right.
But you just notice that they'll have a page and say in 1981, the big thing is Magnum. And then in 1982, the big thing is Knight Rider. The Magnum and Knight Rider page are identical.
Oh, really?
Because it's just, you know, Knight Rider wallet, Knight Rider binoculars, Knight Rider whistle and handcuffs. You know, there's – and that's why I wrote the book, was because of that kind of hilarity to it. You know,
absurdity.
And nobody thinks about this stuff except obsessive guys in their basements in Canada.
That's where you come in.
Hello.
Everybody has to fill a niche.
That's right. And boy, have I.
Have you found yours?
Because you know what? I got a Jackpack catalog from 85. Jackpack are the people that did Matt Houston. And they also did Rocky that year. And they've got the Rocky ID set, the Rocky sunglasses, Rocky bubble fun. And then
so this would have been Rocky 2?
This may have been Rocky 3 or 4.
Okay.
I saw Rocky 3 in 83, so
And yeah, then, Rocky 2 was 79. I remember seeing that in the theater.
But the Matt Houston stuff is primarily guns and the ID set and, you know, detective kit. And I bet if I wander through this catalog enough, I'll just find those guns in three different places, you know?
Right.
And it's all the same picture of Lee Horsley. And it was just, you know.
Something on the air. It was three networks and you had to do something with those molds and that merchandise. Stick someone else on it and, you know, and go with it.
I swear to you, and I haven't found the catalog yet, but somebody even started producing Hill Street Blues rack toys.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, that's as absurd to me as those Dallas prototypes or like the Love Boat. Because if you're thinking about the crossover appeal, I suppose kids would have watched the Love Boat.
Oh my God, it was event television.
The MASH stuff that was just so after its time.
Yeah, that was weird.
So weird. So.
And I could never get over those figures were smiling.
Yeah, they're incredibly happy to be in Korea.
Yeah, they look drunk.
They all signed up. Well, they were most of the show.
I think I did buy a Alan Alda action figure.
Back the original. I remember those at Children's Palace.
Yeah.
I mean, they were everywhere at Children's Palace. Like I remember looking at my watch, going, "What freaking year is
it?" Yeah, it wasn't Farewell, Goodbye, Amen that year.
It was 84.
And that's when the figures came out, weren't they?
Yeah.
It was incredibly late. Yeah.
Yeah, you know the sad thing about MASH, and total boy, are we digressing?
Yeah, where did we go?
That show was such a good. The early run of that show was such a good show. It was so damn funny. Larry Gelbart. In charge of that show. As soon as McLean Stevenson left and BJ came in and, you know, things changed, it was never the same. But that McLean Stevenson, what's his name? Wayne Rogers.
Ferret Face.
It was such a good show. Yeah. It was such a good show.
What happened to that guy?
Wayne Rogers?
Wayne Rogers, I know what happened to Wayne Rogers. Because
Frank Burns died.
Yes, I know that, but like it was like he did MASH. And then he did, like, Boob Academy 4 in the 80s, and then I never saw him again. Yeah, like, he just, bloop, I'm done.
Well, I just think it was so, I mean, it was like an Adam West thing. Like, that character was so huge that anything else he ever tried to do.
Yeah, I think so.
He was so perfect as Frank Burns. It was a brilliant, brilliant performance. Like, he could never do, you know, anything else, unlike Jamie Farr. Who was a bit of a chameleon.
The last... yes. I barely recognized him in Cannonball Run.
There was a famous line. Some colonel is visiting the camp or something, and Klinger's in full drag, you know, doing sentry duty. Walking around, and all of a sudden this colonel comes up to him and says, "Hey, up close, you're a man." And Klinger goes, "From far away, too."
Yeah, when I was last in New York, a couple of years ago, I was in New York City with my wife, and I guess Jamie Farr was doing a play. And
what?
Yeah, it was called Condo to Condo or something. And Jamie Farr's face was all. We were staying not far out of Times Square, and Jamie Farr's face was all over Times Square.
And it
was weird. And then I was listening to. I think I was listening to like the Ron and Fez show, and Ron Bennington said, "Oh, Jamie Farr, I want him on," and they're saying, "Yeah, well, his agent won't let him on until you go see his play," and Ron Bennington's like, "Nah, that's not going to happen. I just wanted to ask him MASH questions, you know, because
I'm really concerned about the play."
Yeah, it was really like a brand. It looked like something that should have been in Branson, Missouri.
You know what would have been great is if you said, "Look, I only want to talk to him about After MASH."
Oh God.
Okay, so if you can fit me into the schedule.
How did we get on Jamie Farr from?
I don't know.
We've missed
you.
Probably 18 different detective shows from the 70s.
I blame you.
Yeah, you know what? The only way I'm going to win this argument is to agree with you. Yeah, so
that's a good point to wrap this up, maybe.
And you know what I think we ought to do is to put a Band-Aid on this is to say we will take cop shows on in the near future and just do cop shows.
That's a good idea, but now we're going to have to leave out all the cop shows you mentioned this episode.
Why? I'll have new bits.
Okay, all right, we'll work on your bits. Let's have a meeting starting tomorrow. We should have the first of like six meetings for the next episode. And on that note, you know, we love ideas too. If anybody has ideas for topics you want us to cover.
Actually, this topic was reader suggested.
It's
really a coincidence, but yeah, it did come up.
I did not know that.
Yeah, well, I shield the public from you.
I know you do. You don't want to be as popular.
I want to treat you like Nora Desmond, and I'll be Max.
Nice.
Yeah.
We left out your favorite. We got to wrap it up with your very favorite.
Heart to Heart.
Heart to Heart.
What a schlock fest that was.
This is age.
That's exactly what I wanted to say was Max's, the way I would stay in the starting. It's like a little bit of OCD I have where I just loved hearing that guy go, "She's gorgeous."
Because
I've never heard a human being say that word like that.
You know what? The things I remember about that were the shittiest dialogue in the history of television. I mean, literally, something would happen in a warehouse and someone would get knocked over and a case of mustard would fall on him. Wagner would go, "I guess he couldn't cut the mustard."
Yeah.
Or something like that. The other thing is the dog was called Freeway. Do you remember that?
Yep.
Dog was called Freeway. And Max, whoever the guy who played Max, my brother Gino, was convinced he was Shemp.
Well, Shemp.
Even as a kid, I'd be like, "Gino, that's not Shemp. That's Shemp. I'm telling you, it's Shemp." It's what
it looks like now. Days before the internet.
Back then I could look it up and go, "You're wrong." But yeah. He was convinced it was Shemp. He's like, "That's what he looks like now."
His name was Lionel J. Stander.
Lionel Stander.
And, he's from the Bronx.
He was in, you know what he was in? Did you ever see Once Upon a Time in the West? I think he was in that. I think he was one of the bad guys in that.
It's very possible.
Great Sergio Leone Western.
I think he may have smoked.
What other show? He tried it once. I think he gave it up. What other show could you launch and say, we're going to talk about detective shows of the 70s and wrap up with mention of a Sergio Leone Western.
And your brother's misidentification of Shemp. Shemp, who, by the way, was long dead by the time.
Even as a kid, I'm trying to tell him, like, that can't be the same guy, Gene. It's him. I'm telling you, it's him. Listen to his voice.
Nobody looked like Shemp.
Exactly. So, who's worse? Curly Joe, the last stooge, or Shemp?
Oh, I love Shemp.
You prefer Shemp?
I'm in the Drew Friedman Shemp fan club there. I've always loved Shemp. I can't stand Joe because I think Joe was sort of the lamest of the bunch. But
he was the pale imitation. He was a terrible imitation. He was like, he wasn't even funny. He just looked like the guy that should be working at the grocery store.
Yeah, like one of them kind of looks like Fred Mertz. And I think that's Joe.
That's Joe. It's cool.
Yeah, and it's sort of like this guy has no personality.
Yeah, you know, like scraping on that one.
Joe Besser was a bit of a ringer because he had his own shtick before they brought him in. But, my God, now we're pontificating on the
stooges. How do we get on the stooges? All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up.
All right.
Another award-winning episode of Pod Stallions. We'll cover everything you don't give a shit about.
Thanks, everybody. And next time we'll have a topic and stick to it.
Yeah, we'll try.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.